Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Of travel I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you very much, Audrey, and welcome back. We've been missing in attendance on the radio network for a week or so, or maybe 2 weeks. And but tonight we're here, and we've got a real special show for you, as we say that about all of them. But the show tonight is very interesting. We're going to have Mr. Daniel Golden present the essentials of his book at the Wisconsin Book Festival. And his book is called Spy Schools. And it's on a subject that probably very few of us know anything about, and it's about the CIA and the FBI and other intelligence agencies infiltrating. And his record, I think, is about 100 colleges and universities in the United States to work on various spy projects. So it'd be very interesting. Remember, we're going to play this off of booktv.org, and remember what that's for. That's where people don't have time to read books, but they can listen to them. Thousands of books are on there now, recorded going back years, and it's, you know, it's a built-in library, and you should do that. The other thing we should mention, if you want your own radio show, it will cost you nothing. All you have to do is sign up at blogtalkradio.com, and within minutes, literally, you could be broadcasting worldwide. At certain times, there is a limited time. The prime times, you got to be beyond 9 o'clock and like before, you know, 5 or something like that. You look that up, but it's free. And you can broadcast worldwide, or you can make it a podcast. And it's available. It's available anyway. They store it on the internet site for Blog Talk Radio. But it's just a fascinating site. Imagine this. I've been doing it for years, over 400 shows, and I still can't believe we do this and we can broadcast worldwide. Go back 30 years in radio, or 40, and what did it take to broadcast worldwide? Well, most did not do anything like that. But anyway, there we are tonight, and we got a little bit of news to take care of before we get started. Some of these things are are very interesting, so I'm going to go ahead and hit on a few of those things. And let's see what we got here for news to start with. Oh, I thought this was a nice one. I really enjoy Judge Pirro. she's on Fox News, the network. But guess what happened to her? Yes, the judge. Where is that article? Audrey, you find it? Yeah, the judge gets a ticket. Here she was speeding, one of the most dangerous things, the most dangerous thing we can do. I've got two other news stories about that in terms of Dayton, Ohio, what they're doing, and some other places. But anyway, the judge, she got caught speeding in northern New York State, and she was going, can you believe that? 119 miles an hour. And a 65 mile per hour zone. We're pushing what? Almost twice the speed limit? But she did it anyway. She's apologized on the radio for it, and she was given a summons for the driving. A lot of places, you're going that fast, they probably would have booked you. But anyway, she's a former Westchester County District Attorney, and she said in a statement she was unaware that she was going nearly double the speed limit at 65. Whoa, I think I'd be checked. She said, I've been driving for hours to visit my ailing 89-year-old mom and didn't realize how fast I was driving. That's something. But she is good. You ever watch her show on Fox News? It's called Justice with Judge Jeanine. And really an interesting show. And she's a bright woman. Anyway, enough about that. Want to go to work for the Border Patrol? That news article was out and recent, and here we are. More than 900 agents leave each year on average, but the Border Patrol only hires an average of 523. They said in a broad survey of staffing and deployment challenges at the key border law enforcement agency. The law requires the agency have a minimum of 21,370, but it had just 19,500. The bigger problem is finding people to do it. And they're looking for, they stacked up. There's an even bigger problem when stacked up against Trump's call for hiring 5,000 more agents to reach a force of 26,370. And anyway, if you want to get a really good job, the Border Patrol is one to do. They operate about 100 miles each way on the border. I've been down there and worked with them once. And you know, very interesting thing. And boy, is this important to our security of our nation. And I don't think the Border Patrol gets enough attention. In fact, some of the news is always negative about them, but they get shot, they get dangered, they get beat up, they get all kinds of things, but they still go to work and they serve us. And it's a thing that's deep in their heart about protecting the integrity of our nation and maintaining our borders. Okay, Ohio's going to get going on reducing the speed. What an idea. The state will target high-crash Ohio roads that have 70-mile-per-hour limits following a report that found a sharp increase in accidents after they raised the limit from 65. And you know enough people, and so do I, that when they raise the limit 5 or 10 miles per hour, what do? They go 20 miles per hour faster. And what's our number one cause of death for people speeding in a short clear distance? And a short clear distance has to do with speeding up on the back of somebody, that type of thing. But Ohio Patrol released a report last week, found a 24% increase in crashes on 70-mile-per-hour roads, including 22% more fatal and injury crashes following that change in 2013. I think it's pretty clear what a state legislature ought to be doing is reduce the speed limit back and look at the lives that we'll save. It went up 24%, 24%. But anyway, they named the roads here. You folks, most of you aren't from Ohio, but you know, it's around. By the way, where do you get hit the most and die in a car? In the states with the lowest population. Because there's nothing to run into, they think. So they speed across Montana and Wyoming and places like that. They have incredible death rates compared to some of the states where, you know, you can't go very fast because you got traffic backed up type of thing. But anyway, that's another subject. I'm not going to really go on this one very long. You've probably done it if you're NRA fans. I know some of you are. But thousands of people who should not have had guns are able to buy them because of an apparent failure of the federal record keeping, according to Sessions. Okay, this is a different story. This is the one that talks about how our NICS system, National Instant Criminal Background Check, has let people by. When they go through the check, they don't catch them. They've got felony records, they got all kinds of things, and I think people need to do something about this. We have all kinds of people who are very decent. People were shot and killed by these creeps, yes, creeps, who bought a gun somewhere legally, quote unquote, and they should have never had it. Back here's another story about a Border Patrol agent dying. He and a second agent, these are ones that they don't even know how they died. It looks like they were beat up with rocks down on the border. And this is the stories out of Texas, about the Texas-Mexican border. And again, these people doing their job in the middle of the night, the daytime. I mean, what a service they're doing to us. And here's one that's lost his life over this particular thing. This was near a culvert near Van Horn, Texas, near the not far from the Mexican border. Okay, let's see. Got a couple more stories here for you. We've been trying to execute this guy, Alva Campbell, for a long time. Ohio governor has now set a new execution date for him and a halfway for a condemned inmate whose pure veins spared him from death. And what's that say? That's a year and a half away for an inmate whose veins spared him his death. What happened here when he's being executed, our prison director, Gary Moore, a good man, called off Campbell's execution morning after the team worked unsuccessfully for 25 minutes to find a usable vein to, drug him up and kill him. But, he wiggled and he shook hands with everybody, guess only, but he did something. By the way, this is, I think, in this case, this is the second murder that he has committed. And his murder was what year, Audrey? Do you remember that? I don't think they put it in the article, but his murder, he fatally shot by Campbell in 1997 was one of the murders. And he was on parole for another shooting, I think, earlier. Don't quote me on that, but I think I have that in another article. He was something else. So we'll have to see what happens with him. You probably know if you ever listen to my show, there are about 8 arguments pro and con on the death penalty. I support about 6 or 7 of them, but I would not do the death penalty. I'm against it because I wouldn't do it. If they asked me to stick him in his veins or shoot a gun to execute him, I wouldn't do it, and I don't want to ask you to do the same thing. But I do believe in life in prison. Life in prison. Oh, my gosh. He shot another person earlier. Carjacked his car and then drove around for several hours before shooting him twice in the head was another one. Oh, my God. Oh, boy. Okay. Well, no, that's the same crime. I'm sorry. I'll look it up and maybe talk to you about it next week. But right, Dayton has got put up speed cameras all over the place. And these speed trailer cameras, they picked up 272,745 vehicles traveling above the speed limit just in October, and more than 20,460 were eligible to receive a warning letter. So they put the thing on warning. The police mailed out 17,955. Dayton, is kind of an electronic city. I think it's got like 4 drone manufacturing plants there now. You got Wright-Patterson Air Force Base right down the road toward Fairborn. But anyway, what the agents are now doing, they are now using speeding guns, the Dayton police. And that's where when you're driving around, they can point the thing at you and boom, it automatically records your speed limit. No matter which way you're going, whether you're behind me or you're beside me if I'm in a patrol car or out in front or crossing the street in front of me, these guns accurately record. By the way, the court has upheld the right that cops are allowed to determine a speed limit by just watching the car. Now, you say you can't do that. Well, if you drive around a squad car, I did that for about nearly 5 years in Dayton, Ohio, as a matter of fact, you can tell how fast they're going because you're used to following these people at a certain distance and that type of thing. But anyway, it's just incredible that's going on. Yeah, the D.C. gun law was declared unconstitutional. That's the one that says a person must have a good reason to fear injury or person or proper theft of their person or property or any other proper reason for carrying a handgun, according to the district police chief. Well, a federal appellate court overthrew that. You don't have to do that in any other state, show that you're in danger, because you never know when you're in danger, right? You've heard my definition of a liberal. Someone hasn't been mugged yet. Hey, if this ain't going to happen to me, yeah, it might. Okay, that's enough on the news tonight. I think we got a couple of blonde jokes here, don't we? I think so. Let's look at this blonde joke. And this first one says, what? the blonde was going on vacation. And he was driving toward the airport, and he saw a sign posted on the side of the road that says airport left. He turned around and went home. He thought the airport had moved. The same blonde, a week or so before, had sold his car for gas money in order to get money for gasoline. What do you think? Oh, maybe you don't like it. Oh, I do. Remember, it's always blonde men when I play them on the radio. So anyway, here's a green tip. It's Christmas time anyway, right? We're still allowed to use the word Christmas, aren't we, Audrey? I think so. I heard the president's doing that now, and the past president didn't. It was always happy holidays. Well, it's Christmas and New Year's and whatever. Anyway, this is a good green tip. It will save energy and the planet. Turn off all your electronic equipment and have, guess what? Guess what you could do? What could you do? You could have a candlelight dinner for Christmas and not use any electric energy to run lights and equipment. Wouldn't that be something? I think that would be just outstanding. So have a candlelight dinner and let us know how that works. All right? Okay. I like that idea. Okay. What we're going to do now is take a listen. I want you to hear as much as you can about this, but you can go to blogtalkradio.com and you can hear Daniel Golden. Golden is his last name. Daniel Golden talking about his book, Spy Colleges. What's it called? Spy Schools, not colleges. Spy Schools, but it's about colleges and universities that were infiltrated by the CIA, who put agents there and then got other people, moved them into spy positions of that type of thing. And again, most of us don't know zip about this, and I think you'll find it very interesting to hear him talk about it. So go to Blog Talk Radio, hear the rest of it, and we'll probably hear, 30 minutes or a half hour about it tonight. But here we go. Give me time to get it set up, and we'll have you listen to this. It's incredible.
Room afterwards, and Dan will be happy to sign them.
This is Stu Levitin introducing.
And if you ask, there will be a question and answer after his talk, and please use the center microphone so C-SPAN can record your question for posterity. and viewing audience. Dan Golden has done serious and important work as an award-winning journalist and author for close to six senior editors at the independent nonprofit newsroom ProPublica, which has as its official mission statement to expose abuses of power and betrayals of the public trust by government, business, and other institutions, using the moral force of investigative journalism to spur reform through the sustained spotlighting of wrongdoing. I think we are safe in assuming that well of stories will not soon run dry. Dan previously worked as managing editor for Education and Enterprise at Bloomberg News, where he edited a series on tax inversions that in 2015 earned Bloomberg News its first ever Pulitzer Prize. He was born in Toledo and went to college in Boston, as they are said to say, graduating magna cum laude. Dan began his career with the Springfield Daily News during the Carter administration, then 17 years with the Boston Globe, including a stint on its famed Spotlight team. He joined the Wall Street Journal's Boston Bureau in 1999 as a senior special writer covering education, and in that capacity received the Pulitzer Prize in 2004 for beat reporting for a series on legacy admissions at elite universities, including his own, as the citation read, for his compelling and meticulously documented stories on admission preferences given to the children of alumni and donors at American universities. He expanded that series into a critically acclaimed 2006 bestseller, The Price of Admission. Interestingly, one of the people he writes about with devastating directness is America's second most famous legacy, a member of Harvard's class of 2003, a young man named Jared Kushner. I do hope the admissions team is proud of itself. Now, when you think about it, it's really no surprise university labs and college classrooms would become the front lines of international espionage. Worldwide clientele, open borders, research, educational ferment, it's a natural. But when you read the details in this book, well, Jean Le Carré calls it shocking, and if Jean Le Carré is shocked, I think we should all be shocked. The Washington Post calls the book important and fascinating. Foreign Policy magazine calls it deeply reported with surprising facts and statistics. His adult hometown, Boston Globe, notes its startling revelations, although, frankly, I don't think anything can startle us anymore. It even has the Marietta Times all aflutter over its revelation of the ties between Marietta College and the University of International Relations in Beijing. This is a topic which has obvious relevance and resonance here at the home of the University of Wisconsin, where in the late 1950s and early 1960s, the dean of admissions was a former CIA recruitment officer. At least he told us he was a former CIA recruitment officer. And where in 1961, former WSA President Ed Garvey, the beloved progressive icon, became president of the National Student Association, which we would find out in 1967 was being secretly funded by same said CIA. And of course, in 1969, Jim Rowan did a series of investigative reports in the Daily Cardinal on the Army Math Research Center. By the way, I'm told by Con Moran that I am allowed to mention that if you want to learn more about Madison in the 60s, come back next year, where if I don't screw up and we don't blow up, there will be a book by exactly that title here at the 2018 Wisconsin Book Festival. That is from my best new friends at the Wisconsin Historical Society Press. The one bit of bad news I have is that the Springfield Daily News is no longer with us. But Dan Golden is.
I'm going to move it up a little bit. I think people who introduce distinguished guests should take about two paragraphs, and that's it.
Here, you know, I've heard
this
about
is Mr. Golden
for many years, and I can see it looks beautiful even in the rain. A funny thing, you know, as a higher education reporter, you know, for many years, I've visited dozens, you know, if not hundreds of colleges and universities in the U.S., but for some reason, I've never visited the University of Wisconsin, you know, for a story, and I can only assume that's because the university has always been perfectly run, and so there was nothing at all for me to investigate. But I'm glad to be here now.
So Spy Schools is a work of investigative reporting, and so you won't find the word I in it a whole lot, but it's actually quite personal for me. It explores the intersection of two cultures that have long interested me, universities and espionage. I've spent a lot of my life in and around academia. Both my parents were professors at the University of Massachusetts' flagship campus in Amherst, and I used to hang out there after school and on the weekends, going to basketball and football games and playing pinball and eating in the campus center cafeteria. My favorite meal there was the delicious Red Baron, which was a cheeseburger with a fried egg on it, which may explain why I have a stent today. Now, there aren't any spies in my family tree that I'm aware of, but as a teenager, I devoured a lot of spy novels by John le Carré, who was kind enough to praise this book, and Eric Ambler and others. And, of course, I enjoyed the Mad Magazine Spy versus Spy cartoons. And I sometimes think the career that I chose as an investigative journalist is in a way a cross between being a professor and a spy. You know, like a scholar, an investigative journalist delves into court records and dusty historical documents. And like a spy, he or she pursues secrets and develops informants. As a young reporter at the Boston Globe and on its Spotlight team, that was back in the days when reporters were still allowed to gather information under, you know, false backgrounds. And so I sometimes worked undercover, posing for various stories as a money launderer in the Cayman Islands, as a security guard, and as a homeless person. Luckily, that last one didn't require much of a change in my customary attire at the time. My book's theme is that the globalization of American universities has transformed them into a front line for espionage. Some small but intriguing percentage of the more than 1 million foreign students and hundreds and thousands of foreign faculty and researchers and visiting scholars in the U.S. come to help their countries gain scientific secrets and sources on American policy. The FBI and the CIA reciprocate, cultivating international students and researchers whom they hope to send home as our agents. You know, maybe this topic hasn't drawn a lot of journalistic attention, maybe because it kind of falls between two different journalistic beats, national security and higher ed. So I was able to dig up a lot of new and startling information and case studies of the penetration of spies into American colleges and universities, from renowned schools like Harvard, MIT, and Duke to lesser known places like the University of South Florida and Marietta College in Ohio. American universities, I found, ignore or even condone the domestic and foreign espionage on their campuses, partly for financial reasons. They're opening branches abroad, which are often subsidized by the host countries, and they're ramping up enrollment of full-paying international students while also receiving funding for research and a ever-proliferating variety of programs from U.S. intelligence agencies. So they don't want to offend either the foreign countries or the U.S. Government. Key moments, both in the late 1970s, fostered this surge in campus spying. The first was the failure of the last significant push to block covert CIA activity on campus. After a U.S. Senate investigation revealed that the CIA was using several hundred academics for, quote, providing leads and on occasion making introductions for intelligence purposes, unquote, Harvard University, my alma mater, became concerned. It prohibited students and faculty from undertaking intelligence operations for the CIA and from helping the CIA recruit foreign students under false pretenses. But the CIA rejected Harvard's guidelines and made clear that it had no intention of following them, and hardly any other universities adopted them, so the whole effort came to naught. And since then, and especially since 9/11, universities have become far more accommodating to U.S. intelligence. Harvard itself recently bowed to pressure from the CIA and rescinded an invitation to Chelsea Manning to be a visiting fellow. The second pivotal moment was China's opening to the West and its decision in 1978 to begin sending students to the U.S., which was motivated in part by a desire to catch up to us in science and technology. Shortly afterwards, incidentally, the FBI began noticing signs of an increase in campus spying, such as a spike in the use of copying paper. As the FBI's senior resident agent from 1982 to 1984, right here in Madison, Harry Skip Brandon, watched the influx of Chinese students to the University of Wisconsin. Sometimes their Xeroxing bills were very high, almost humorously so, he told me. We wondered how they shipped all this stuff back. China now accounts for almost one-third of international students in the U.S. and about 15% of foreign-born researchers and scientists. The vast majority pose no threat and, like other newcomers, infuse American universities with energy and fresh perspectives. But some may have other agendas, like Ruopong Liu, a Chinese graduate student at Duke University. As I recount in my book, Liu poached Pentagon-funded research at Duke on creating an invisibility cloak that could hide American weapons. Exploiting an unwary professor and lax collaboration guidelines, he arranged for a collaboration with Chinese scientists who visited the Duke lab and photographed the equipment it had built. He also deceived the professor into committing to share his research in China, and he secretly started a website hosted in China that was based on Duke's research. The professor eventually began to suspect him and took away his key to the lab, but Duke still awarded Liu a doctorate. Afterwards, he returned to China, where he used the work at Duke to start a competing institute in business with Chinese government support, financial support, and became a billionaire. I was talking to a customer in a bookstore the other day, and he said, well, you know, espionage is good because it helps countries understand each other. And I said, you know, maybe so, but there's a lot of collateral damage. And that's partly what my book is about. You know, I tell the stories of vulnerable students who were sucked in unwittingly or because they were young and impressionable and didn't know any better, and of professors who were pressured or enticed to spy. One case I go into detail is University of South Florida professor Dajin Pong, who was one target of this pressure. He was born and bred in China, but is a U.S. citizen. And at South Florida, he was director of something called the USF Confucius Institute. China staffs and funds hundreds of these institutes of language and culture on campuses worldwide, and the FBI and other Western intelligence agencies tend to regard them as havens for spies. That's one reason they were interested in Pong. They suspected him of spying for China, and they wanted to turn him into a double agent. So he got in trouble at USF for various transgressions, from expense account finagling to having, quote, a large cache of sexually related images with disturbing thematic content, unquote, on his university computer. And an FBI agent then went to him and gave him a choice. She basically said that he could lose his tenured professorship and possibly go to jail for his financial transgressions, or he could keep his prestigious position. They would persuade the university not to fire him, and he could spy on China and the Confucius Institute for the FBI. As this went along, the FBI even asked South Florida to set up a branch campus in China that he could use as a base for spying. And it plays out, there's an interesting denouement, which I'll, you know, I hope you read the book and then see what happened to Professor Pong. One highlight of the reporting process was my legal battle with the FBI, which I would like to tell you about. One tactic that I used to gather information was to send public records requests to state universities asking for their communications with the FBI and the CIA. I could have sent the request to the FBI and the CIA, but I figured it would take them years or decades to respond, if they responded at all. And, you know, I'm no longer a young man, and the prospect was bleak. So I went to the universities instead and tried this end around. And, you know, most of the universities, as I expected, did respond, reasonably quickly, including, as I recall, Wisconsin. And one of the places I contacted was the New Jersey Institute of Technology, which I chose because it has a high proportion of foreign graduate students in the sciences who might be targets for recruitment. And So I contacted NJIT, and they got back to me right away and said, oh, yes, we have at least 4,000 pages of emails with the FBI that we'll be glad to send to you. So I said, wonderful. And then the package arrived, and virtually all of the 4,000-plus pages were completely blacked out. So I hired a pro bono law firm, which is the only kind of law firm I can afford to hire, the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press in Washington, and we sued the university. And its defense was, this isn't our fault. The FBI sent 8 agents to our campus, and they went through the documents and redacted them all. And then the university turned around and sued the FBI. So we had this 3-ring circus in federal court, and the FBI took the position, which I considered bizarre, that, you know, the emails that it sent to these universities still belong to the Bureau, even though it was the sender and not the recipient. It's like, you know, if I send you a Christmas present, now it's yours. It's not mine anymore. And I didn't understand their logic. And apparently they didn't really understand, you know, want to go too far with this either, because presumably being afraid of setting a damaging precedent, they ultimately settled the case and gave me most of the emails, which you'll see sprinkled in different parts through the book. And, you know, looking back, I find it somewhat ironic that the FBI was so eager and happy to tell the world about Hillary Clinton's emails, but it was very desperate to cover up its own. I'd like to think this book is quite timely. For example, as Russian spying dominates the nightly news, spy schools documents Russian espionage on American campuses. You know, in that regard, I was interested to note, you know, the other day that the Trump campaign foreign policy advisor, the liaison between him and the Putin regime, was a mysterious London-based professor. Similarly, Chinese theft of intellectual property is a prominent topic in the media and in my book. And the biggest fault line in American and global politics today is nationalism versus globalization. That's the conflict that surfaced in Brexit and in our presidential campaign and in the French campaign. It's also at the heart of the campus spy wars. Intelligence services essentially pursuing, you know, national goals are taking advantage of the international culture of universities. And academic conferences, which are the ultimate sort of global jet set events, are crawling with spies, both foreign and American. I'd like to read you two brief excerpts to just give you a sense of what my book is like. And one is about foreign spying, essentially one's about American spying. And the first one is about the experience of an American professor not so long ago, a few years ago, whom Russia tried to recruit. And here goes. This is the first one. A professor at one top-tier East Coast university enjoys wearing his $800 Victorinox Swiss Army watch to dinner parties. It's the ultimate conversation piece, a bribe from a Russian spy. He had considered a CIA career, but the agency wasn't hiring. He'd gone into academia instead, making his name as a foreign policy expert and still occasionally wondering if he had a talent for espionage. Then, in 2010, he got an unexpected chance. He was moderating a campus discussion on arms control. Afterward, a Russian diplomat approached him and one of the panelists, gave them his card, and invited them to lunch. Because they held security clearances, the professor and his colleague were obliged to run this overture past the FBI. A contacted FBI counterintelligence soon called the professor and said that the diplomat was believed to be a foreign intelligence officer. I guess I won't meet him for lunch, the professor said. That's one option, the FBI agent said. We prefer you to meet him. Over the next 2 years, the Russian and the FBI each treated the professor to 10 lunches. He would dine with the Russian spy at Mexican restaurants, French bistros, and steakhouses, never the same place twice, because his host was worried about counter-surveillance. The Russian always paid cash, $100 bills, straight from an operational fund. Afterward, the professor would call the FBI agents, who would take him to lunch a few days later and debrief him. The spy was in his late 30s, muscular and swarthy,
with a high forehead and deep-set eyes, reminiscent of Russian president and former KGB officer Vladimir Putin. He plied the professor with gifts of increasing value. First, a fine bottle of Posolskaya vodka, which was especially appropriate coming from a spy under diplomatic cover, because Posolskaya means ambassador in Russian, and then the Swiss watch. Do you want the watch? The professor asked the FBI agents. Don't you want to check for bugs? No need, they told him. It was unlikely to be bugged. He could keep it. At last, the Russian proposed a trade, cash for information. The amount of the payment would depend on the quality of the information. To prevent exposure, he said, the professor should buy a laptop that he would never connect to the internet, write on it, and supply the file to the Russian on a flash drive. The spy would then insert the drive into a secure computer in the nearest Russian diplomatic facility and send a cable to Moscow. The FBI instructed the professor to play along without providing any classified secrets. He wrote an authoritative-sounding discussion of the Afghanistan war on his own laptop and gave the flash drive to the Russian. At their next lunch, the spy handed over $2,000 in $100 bills. He also made clear to his recruit that publicly available information, no matter how well analyzed, would not suffice. We appreciate it, but we didn't think it was that sensitive, he told the professor. We can pay you more if you give us more. That's the first excerpt, and the second is from my chapter on academic conferences. And the idea here is that about a decade ago, the CIA devised a stratagem that in order to prevent Iran from developing a nuclear bomb. And the idea was that it would identify Iranian nuclear scientists who were critical to Iran's program, and then set up sort of fake academic conferences outside Iran in the scientists' field of research or interest. Then they would invite the scientists again through intermediaries, so the CIA's role would be hidden, have the scientist come to the conference, separate him from his handlers that would come along with him, and try and get him to defect to the U.S. And this was it had some successes and some failures, which I go into in the chapter. And here's a little passage about what that was like. The CIA agent tapped softly on the hotel room door. After the keynote speeches, panel discussions, and dinner, the conference attendees had retired for the night. Audio and visual surveillance of the room showed that the nuclear scientist minders from the Islamic Revolutionary Guard Corps were sleeping, but he was still awake. Sure enough, he opened the door alone. The agency had been preparing this encounter for months. Through a business front, it had funded and staged the conference at an unsuspecting foreign institution of scientific research, invited speakers and guests, and planted operatives among the kitchen workers and other staff, just so it could entice the nuclear expert out of Iran, separate him for a few minutes from his guards, and pitch him one-on-one. A last-minute snag had almost derailed the plans. The target switched hotels because the conference's preferred hotel cost $75 more than his superiors in Iran were willing to spend. To show his sincerity and goodwill, the agent put his hand over his heart. "Salam Habibi," he said. "I'm from the CIA, and I want you to board a plane with me to the United States." The agent could read the Iranian's reactions on his face, a mix of shock, fear, and curiosity. From prior experience with defectors, he knew the thousand questions flooding the scientist's mind. What about my family? How will you protect me? Where will I live? How will I support myself? How do I get a visa? Do I have time to pack? What happens if I say no? The scientist started to ask one, but the agent interrupted him. "First, get the ice bucket," he said. "Why?" "If any of your guards wake up, you can tell them you're going to get some ice." So, as I hope you can tell from these excerpts, I tried to make this book both revelatory and fun to read, kind of like a thriller, only true. And whether I succeeded, you know, you'll be the judge, but, you know, I hope you take a chance on it and enjoy it. And thanks again for coming. And I'd love to take questions. As Stu mentioned, just go to the microphone there in the aisle and ask whatever comes to mind. Thank you. Thanks. Sure.
Recruitment of U.S. students. Did you encounter that at all from the CIA?
Good question. Yeah, well, of course, recruitment of U.S. folks is very common, but it's above board and overt in a lot of cases, right? I mean, the CIA and the FBI will come to campus, and by law, the rules say that, you know, for their staffs, they have to hire U.S. citizens. So they come, they hold career fairs, they hold events, they hold crisis simulations, and students attend and they hire them. And, you know, I have no problem with that. I mean, I think that it's fine that, you know, they're identifying themselves and saying they're recruiters. So, you know, all those examples, I didn't deal with them a lot in my book, but I do tell the story. I went to one of these recruiting sessions. And, I mean, as I say, I think that's very appropriate. Now, there may be times when they use a different method of recruiting a U.S. citizen, such as the case with Professor Pong at South Florida, where they exerted some pressure on him. Again, because he had high-level connections in China, they were quite interested in him. And there may also be, you know, sort of covert recruiting of Americans, that not through the open recruiting session, to do other things, professors or students. American professor might have a particular expertise in weaponry or in the Middle East or something, and they will recruit that person, but it's they identify themselves. You know, it's there's limits on how far the CIA can go with a U.S. citizen without identifying itself. So, again, I'm focusing on the ones where the foreigner is a foreigner who's unwitting or is under pressure. Now, there is another side to the coin, though, which is that many, many American students go overseas, right, and study abroad programs. There's, you know, some hundreds of thousands now. And in those cases, they may be prey to foreign intelligence agencies using the same kind of tactics, essentially, that we use here for foreign students. So I tell the story of Glenn Duffy Shriver. Some of you may be familiar with this one. He was a student at Grand Valley State in Michigan. He went over to China on a study abroad program, fell in love with the country, learned Chinese, went back a number of times. And when he went back right after graduation, didn't have a job, he was hard up for money. And, you know, through a ruse, pretending to be from like Shanghai municipal government offering him work, the Chinese intelligence ultimately recruited him and paid him $70,000 to try and penetrate the U.S. government. He was caught trying to get a job, you know, trying to get into the CIA, and he was imprisoned. And, you know, that's kind of a cautionary tale, because he was pretty much, you know, an ordinary American kid. He didn't have, was no science genius or anything like that. And they, you know, they laid out what's a lot of money for an intelligence service to recruit him. And, you know, my understanding from people I talked to is that, you know, China has a whole intelligence unit devoted to recruiting Western students, and the attractive young woman that they used to lure him apparently had, you know, other people had reported, you know, approach, other students had reported approaches from her as well. So, you know, it can be worrisome for, you know, U.S. citizens overseas and in the, you know, in the wrong country at the wrong time.
Who are potentially recruiting international students, how would a professor end up not in the situation like the one that you described initially?
Like the Duke situation.
Yeah.
Well, a couple of things. That was a case where there were very few sort of guidelines governing this collaboration with China, and I think that's pretty typical. You know, he brought in, you know, the Chinese graduate student was able to take advantage of kind of a murky situation. So, for example, he arranges this collaboration with these Chinese researchers, and they come over and photograph the equipment and study the equipment that Duke built. Well, is that against the rules or isn't it? There was no written agreement that said you can or you can't photograph things. And the same with kind of all the other stuff he did, the setting up of the website. And, you know, and so it's one of those things where these arrangements should be spelled out in advance. Here's what we'll share with you. Here's what we'll keep to ourselves. Here's what, you know, you can do when you come here, and here's what we can do when we go there, and that's it. You know, so that would have helped a lot. And then the other thing is, I don't know if it would have helped in this case, but, you know, there might be, you know, things worth looking more closely at in the application process. This doesn't apply to the Duke case, but in the Marietta chapter that I wrote, you know, Marietta has this partnership with this university in China that appears like a normal university, but is actually partly funded and supervised by China's intelligence ministry. And it's, you know, in China, it's known as the spy school, and it trains a lot of Chinese spies. Quite a few of its graduates come to this country. They work for American businesses. They go to grad school at American universities. And that was one reason, actually, why Dajin Pong was of interest to the FBI, because he had gone to that university as a grad student. And, you know, the vast majority are probably not spies. Not everybody who goes to that university is. But, you know, that's something where it's at least universities ought to know when they look at the resume, oh, you know, this person went to the University of International Relations. You know, that's kind of a, you know, warning sign. Maybe we should check with U.S. intelligence as to, you know, what we should do, you know, or ask this person about it in the admissions process. So, but in terms of the research, I think, you know, it's time for just basic written agreements. I mean, I'm a believer in globalization. I certainly don't want to stop research between the U.S. and other countries. I mean, I think it's one of the great virtues of universities that they, you know, attract bright minds from all over the world. But there is this kind of naivete about the whole thing. You know, in this case, it was basic research. So it wasn't, you know, classified. It wasn't secret. But other countries are also interested in getting on the inside of basic research because it can take a long time to publish the results. They can find out about it a lot quicker if they're actually involved in it, and they can also find out what mistakes to avoid so that they can replicate it a lot faster. So there has to be. So they're very interested in this kind of basic research, open source information. They aren't just interested in classified stuff. So, you know, it behooves universities just to keep a closer eye and to make sure that they have written stipulations before they kind of get into this kind of mess.
You were dealing with individuals and institutions who lie and deceive as part of their normal daily life. Could you, beyond just getting the emails, could you talk about the verification process and the difficulties you faced there? And were there any really great stories that you just couldn't nail down to your satisfaction for confirmation and had to leave out?
Well, I don't want to mention the ones that I couldn't verify because, you know, I could get into trouble there. There's a reason why I left them out. But, you know, it's obviously, you know, this is not easy reporting. I mean, I think that because I've covered higher education, I approached it more from that side. So I got a lot of stories from professors about their dealings with the intelligence agencies, you know, as well as maybe from former intelligence people talking about their dealings. I mean, I'll talk about one reporting method I'm proud of, which is the chapter about the Kennedy School at Harvard, which, of course, is, you know, one of the premier public policy programs in the country. And what I report in that chapter is basically that for decades, the CIA intelligence officers have been enrolling undercover in the Kennedy School's mid-career program, which is predominantly about two-thirds foreigners, the program, two-thirds or three-fourths. And they're, you know, future foreign leaders, foreign business people, foreign government officials who are on the way up in their countries. That's why they're admitted. And so naturally, they're very desirable recruiting targets for the CIA. And these CIA officers enroll in the program, said they might have been, you know, overseas for a few years. And then, you know, they're between assignments, so the CIA sends them to the Kennedy School. And the kind of party line there is, oh, they don't recruit, they're just there to study. But, you know, anybody who knows about these mid-career programs knows that, you know, a lot of it is networking, you know. It's and so
you know, they go out for beers afterward, they get to know each other, and they may not be officially recruiting the foreigner, but they're not saying they're in the CA. They're posing usually as State Department foreign service officers or political officers from this or that embassy. And, you know, the unwitting foreigner becomes friends with them. And then when the after the program, when the foreigner goes home and the CIA guy goes back overseas, he can continue tapping his old classmate for information. And the guy might never know he was in the CIA, you know, that his buddy is in the CIA. So one of the ways I got that was, I got a tip that this was going on, and I said, well, how am I going to verify this? You know, how am I going to prove this? So I as a Harvard alum, I had access to the libraries, and so it turned out that the Kennedy School Library had about 30 years of photo rosters for the mid-career program, you know, until it all went internet in like 2012 or something, from maybe 1980 to 2012. They had this book in which you could there was a roster. So I went through it, and I basically picked out everybody who said they were from the State Department, a political officer, and particularly, you know.
We're going to shut him off right there. You can go to booktv.org and look up Daniel Golden, and the book is called Spy Schools, and he'll finish that story about the program at Harvard. But hey, you do know and recall I've had experience with the Romanians in terms of helping them come both to the United States and to go overseas there and work and start academic programs over there. But they're very good people, and they're trying very hard to recover from their communist background. But anyway, that's we're going to say that's it for tonight. We're going to ask Vera Lynn to sign us off, as she usually does, singing this wonderful song, We'll Meet Again.
We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know, tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day.